Good evening, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of the lockdown lectures hosted by Bodhi Commons. This is Abid, and I will be moderating the session today. Let them eat cake. Though there is no conclusive historical evidence that this was uttered by the Queen of France, it captures a much potent point, that of the general disdain of the ruling class towards the plight of the working poor in terms of crisis. The modern Indian equivalent of let them eat cake would be something like let them light diyas, which is unfortunately the state of India right now. One can only hope that the light that the Prime Minister wishes to see in the darkness is not the light from a train that is approaching directly at us from the other side. Today, we have with us Professor Ram Kumar, who is to enlighten on the socio-economic crisis that the coronavirus pandemic has triggered. Professor Ram Kumar is a development economist and NABARD chair professor at TIS Mumbai. He has worked extensively on agrarian change, agriculture credit policies, rural livelihoods, and has contributed to the debate on the Aadhaar project as well as the impact of demonetization in India. He's also a member of the planning board in Kerala, and thus his insights are often accompanied by a rich experience in heterodox policy making well. Professor Ram Kumar will be speaking on the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Over to you, Professor Ram Kumar.
Thank you, Abid. Am I audible? Just to check the audio.
Yes, sir. You are audible.
Thank you. Let me, to begin with, thank Bodhi Commons for what is a very excellent initiative during the time of lockdown. It's a very auspicious time, I'm told, to be speaking on a topic like this, because 9 p.m., 9 minutes, the switching off of lights and the jalowing of diya is probably going on at present, and that gives me an auspicious aura as well. Let me start by saying the following. Now, this crisis related to coronavirus is very different from all these types of crises in that there is both a compression of demand and a compression of supply. Now, those who have studied a little bit of economics would know that microeconomics textbooks refer to this kind of phenomenon as a rather unique situation whereby both demand and supply fall, and as a result, prices become indeterminate. It is not possible to judge what will be an equilibrium price. Whether there will be equilibrium at all is unclear. So it's a sort of an unclear situation for textbook economics as well. Now, the other issue that arises here is that if you look at a textbook case of demand and supply graphs that all of you may have seen at some point in your life, there is a backward shifting of both the demand curve and the supply curve. As a result, what happens is, it's very difficult to say what started first, whether it is demand that starts first, a demand shock that began first, or supply shock that began first. Let us not worry about that at this point of time. Let's assume that demand fell to begin with. The fall in demand leads to a fall in supply, and a fall in supply again leads to a fall in demand, and this fall in demand again leads to a fall in supply, and there is a backward loop that sort of functions between demand and supply. As a result, output and demand is constantly diminished over a period of time if this continues as a cycle. Now, so this kind of backward loop is a real problem with this kind of a phenomenon in economics. If it goes on looping backwards, then output can really diminish to a very significant level after a point of time. Now, as I said, the shock is exogenous here. It's a disease. It's a virus. It is not a financial crisis. At the same time, the crisis slowly begins to develop within the real economy and also from the real economy after a point of time. And the moment it starts to originate and spread within the real economy, what you have is you have spillovers from the real economy. For example, when large number of people lose jobs, companies are shut down, restaurants are shut down, movie halls are shut down, etc. They all have taken some loan at some point in their lives. So all these loans remain unpaid, and slowly this real economy crisis spills over into the banking sector and the financial sector as a crisis in those spheres. So that's the first spillover that you will have. The second spillover that you will have is with the external sector. That is, there are no exports happening anywhere. As a result of no exports happening, there is no foreign exchange reserves that countries are able to build up in order to finance imports at that point of time. Remittances start falling because everywhere across the world, we have a problem of jobs. So remittances start coming down. All these are external spillovers of the crisis. So basically, you have is slowly it becomes a more generalized crisis, having begun from an unknown source in wildlife, as they say it. Now, the question, so the point, the first point that I want to make is this is not a usual crisis. This is neither a demand shortfall, nor a supply shock, nor a financial sector speculative crisis. This is something that is unique. Humankind has not faced it very often in the past. You can think of the Spanish flu of 1918, but remember, the Spanish flu of 1918 did not affect the global economy in terms of a lockdown and so on, the way it is doing now. There is some literature on this which says that the public awareness about the Spanish flu itself was very limited at that point of time. Very few people, in fact, knew that a crisis of that sort is out there. Now, so that's the first point that I wanted to make. The second point is, so what has to be done about this? I'll come to that in a short while. Before that, I need to sort of flag two issues that I feel are important. I did not hear that lecture, but I think Professor Jayaraman gave a lecture 2 days back, and I think he would have touched upon this in some way, but I will sort of just mention it here nevertheless. One is, there is a lot of discussion, being people from the left, there's a lot of discussion that goes around with regard to capitalism and health, capitalism and healthcare. Now, this is a very complex subject. It is not possible for us to say, as many people have been saying, you can read it all over the social media and some of the articles that come up on important websites, you will see that it is capitalism that has given rise to this kind of a health crisis. And as a result, the transcending of capitalism is necessary to get over this health crisis. Now, there is in some sense, a difficulty in going with this argument that way. Important point that we have to remember is that the Spanish flu of 1918 is supposed to have killed something like 50 million people all over the world. So, and before that, you had cholera outbreaks, you had different smallpox outbreaks, etc. The key shift that happens by the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century is that there is great advancement of science and technology that happens alongside the evolution of capitalism itself. Now, this means that there is discovery of germ theory. There is awareness about a lot of preventive steps that humankind can take, prophylactic measures. There is the cautious postulate, which tells you how to isolate and between the two world wars that we had in the first half of the 20th century, these measures came to be, and also different vaccination measures, came to be adopted as part of public health systems in the capitalist world itself, primarily Europe. Now, this meant that if you look at the history of healthcare and the mortality rates, infant maternity, life expectancy rates, etc., post this first half of the 20th century, you will see enormous progress having been made by countries, particularly in Europe, because these advancements in health and health science and medical science were incorporated into public health in a major way as part of the emergence and development of the welfare state capitalism. Now, this meant that in some sense, the value of life, the value of preserving lives has enormously increased in the world, which is also a capital of this. So, I also remember the need that millions of that that is the 19th century, 18th century, and before that, we don't see that in the half of the 20th century. There are, I'm aware, the Asian flu of 1956, which is the Hong Kong flu of 1960, which is 1 million people. But remember, the mortality rates were relatively lower than during the earlier episodes. This holds true for the SARS episode in China in 2002. So that's a key difference. That's a key point to remember when we discuss capitalism and health in some sense. The second is this whole literature that has been coming in from different sources is that the structure of production that exists in capitalism has a close correlation with the nature of outbreak of epidemics that we see. Yeah, thank you. So the second point that I wanted to make was related to the structure of production under capitalism and epidemics. In particular, there is a lot of discussion about this new book called Big Farms Cause Big Flu by Robert Wallace. The whole argument being made is that the large-scale, intensified, capital-intensive production structure under capitalism is in some sense the reason why flus of this sort break out very quickly and rapidly spread. Now, there is again something that there's a qualification that needs to be brought in here. It's not a sort of simple cause and effect question that we are dealing with here. This kind of virus, particularly the spread of zoonotic diseases that we are seeing around us today, these are a result of primarily two sets of problems. One is these can come about largely because of increased contacts between humans and livestock through deforestation. That is a very important phenomenon. The second is that there can be, with or without deforestation, increased proximity of humans, wildlife, and livestock. This is an issue that one has to, in some sense, face with the emergence of this kind of large-scale farming systems. They suspect large number of serious zoonotic diseases from, what is it, Hendra, Nipah, Ebola, etc. There is greater contact between livestock and humans in close proximity, there is a rare chance for these viruses to jump from animal life bats to humans and livestock. Remember, in 1999 in Malaysia, it was a massive drought that forced bats out of the forests and into orchards in search of food. Similarly, Nipah jumped from bats to swine to humans. Now, what is important here is that there is a greater emphasis that has always been required and that will more importantly be required on biosecurity in the future years that we would see. Biosecurity has to be given much more importance to reduce the possibilities of zoonotic diseases jumping from wildlife to livestock and humans. So this is in some sense a question of science. This is a question of how science will ultimately deal with these questions through not just through vaccinations, but also through improved biosecurity measures. So this whole question of capitalism's large-scale structure of production being the primary and proximate cause for this spread of epidemics is too complex a question to be sort of reduced into very catchy book titles like Big Farms Cause Big Flu. I am not in agreement with this kind of explanations. The second point that I want to bring to notice is that this debt crisis has over a period of time enormously expanded, has become much more serious than in the past. In particular, particular, corporate has become a very, very important point of the meaning of capitalist has been founded in today's economies. Most of this debt is also of very poor quality. In the sense, these are not debts which are backed up by adequate real assets that can be monetized. And so it's not just the quantum of debt, there's also an enormous amount of poor quality debt that we see around us. Second, the third context that we need to remember is related to neoliberalism and the health sector itself. Now, from the mid-70s or late-70s onwards, the ideology of neoliberalism, later the Washington Consensus, structural adjustment, stabilization, all these measures have meant that the health systems of most countries of the world has significantly deteriorated in quality and in some sense quantity as well. Now, what we mean by this is, for example, if you take economies like the like of Great Britain or the societies of continental Europe, you will see that while public health systems remain an important part of their healthcare programs, healthcare systems, you nevertheless see that over the last 30 or 40 years, there is significant weakening of these public health systems in terms of the equipment, in terms of personnel, in terms of care staff, in terms of number of hospitals and clinics, which have over a period of time meant that the ability of the capitalist welfare state so meticulously built up. So this has meant, for example, in UK, the Thatcher period onwards, saw a weakening of the NHS. NHS has not disappeared. It's so dear to British people. But archives that have been declassified over the last few years show that there were large number of steps in the administration which contributed to a weakening of the NHS itself. In fact, one of the most important points of Jeremy Corbyn in Britain was that so the efforts to privatize NHS have been ongoing, and in the process, the system has got significantly weaker over the years. The second is that if you look at the other model of healthcare in the Western world, which is the insurance-based model of the Anglo-Saxon world, that is, let's get up for United States, that insurance systems have been totally incapable of meeting the health needs and requirements of the lowest sections of the population. So you will see that the ability of the welfare state of capitalism to meet an emergency of this sort is very weak. Now, it was Lawrence Summers who asked, why is it that the largest economy, this is the richest economy of the world, does not have enough masks, cannot produce enough masks? Well, that's a question that he should ask himself, because it's people like him who basically entrenched this insurance-based model of healthcare. Always push forward arguments against single-payer systems of insurance systems in the United States, and the rise of neoliberalism, which has aided the makeup of public health systems, is something that is unmistakable over the last 3 or 4 decades. Nigel Kanitkar, which are using simple input-output framework, shows that our losses are also somewhere between 22% to 40%. That's the nature of, as a percentage of GDP, the extent of destruction that we would see, 20% to 32%. That's the kind of range that she arrives at. So in India as well, you see the kind of impact that we see of this sort. Some of these economies that we are talking about have impacts which are far more than 20 or 25%. In a country like Greece, it is supposed to be 33%. In a country like Mexico, it is supposed to be 30%. We are talking of percentage of GDP at constant prices that is lost. because of this shutdown. So for many countries, it is also the extent of destruction of GDP is also to the extent of about 1/3, which is not something that we have seen. Remember, and this is something that bothers me when I give a talk like this, is that much of what I say is also in some sense speculative, in the sense that we still do not know when the shutdowns or lockdowns will end. We still do not know when there will be a vaccine. We still do not know whether there will be a second coming of this virus in November. We still do not know the extent to which it will spread in a country like India. We have some idea about the United States now. So these are there are enormous amounts of unknowns in this kind of story that we are talking about. So it's also all these estimates are in some sense preliminary, and also all the recommendations that we provide as solutions are also in some sense speculative, in the sense that we don't quite know what is going to happen if we take a measure like X, Y, or Z. So ILO calculated that the extent of job loss across the world would be 25 million in the early times of the crisis. That would have to be at least quadrupled by now. It's not about 2.5 crore or 3 crore that we are talking about, but we are at least talking about 8 to 10 crore worth of unemployment. World Food Program, WFP, has noted that COVID-19 crisis is threatening to affect millions of people already made vulnerable by food insecurity and malnutrition. Examples from the outbreak in Africa in the last decade would tell us that this kind of impacts on livelihood, hunger, malnourishment, etc., is likely to be extraordinarily large. There is also impact on farmers who are unable to harvest their produce, are facing sharply falling prices, are unable to harvest because of shortage of workers. Processing industries are not working because the workers have gone home. Milk procurement is not happening because of lockdown. Supply chains are disrupted all across. All these are issues that affect agriculture. Government is not able to procure food. One-third to 30% of 30 to 35% of the lorries are supposed to be unavailable because there are no drivers to drive them. Many lorries are, about 5 lakh lorries are supposed to be stuck without being able to move forward. Yeah. I'm continuing. Yeah. Okay. So the whole question of I was talking about the its impacts on employment, hunger, agriculture, informal in those countries where informal sectors are the predominant section of workers have met the kind of exodus that you saw in Delhi towards Uttar Pradesh or different parts of the country towards. The country, they just show the kind of I'm not calling it an that's the nature of those that exist here. Mobility country, and it needed a very inhuman sort so that we know of this kind of this one. Of migratory labor that we have had in our country. So the impacts are very large. Deal with a contingency. Now, this is technically true because, yes, the world has the adequate amount of food stocks. But remember, 52% of the world wheat stocks that we call comfortable are held by China. About 20% of the world rice stock that we call comfortable is held by India. If tomorrow, if the lockdown proceeds and we are not able to contain the virus, And India and China decide not to export the same quantities that they used to in the past, then remember the comfort of world food stocks, anything for nation states, if trade stops. So the extent of comfort that we often draw from the fact that we have enough food stocks is some illusion, because world stocks are not the same as national stocks, and you need trade. And if countries by their sovereign power decide not to trade, then you could very clearly see that food crisis will emerge very fast. Look at countries like Philippines, European Union, United States, all these countries which are significantly, or one of the top rice importers of the world. Second, it is a great time for monetary authorities, because they will see that inflation rate is falling across the world. Now, remember, this falling of inflation is a very important indicator of the extent to which food consumption has declined across the world after the outbreak of the virus began. Look at. I'll give you an example from Mumbai, where I live, which is the nearest APMC market that we have is in this place called Vashi, APMC Vashi. Now, if you go to Vashi on a normal day, you would see that 800 trucks arrive every day with tomatoes, potatoes, fruits, whatnot, rice. Once the lockdown, instead of 800 trucks arriving every day, only 150 to 200 trucks come every day. Now, this means that your arrival in the market is down by about 70 to 80%. You actually have only about 20 to 25% of the arrival on a daily basis. Despite this kind of fall in arrival, prices are not rising. Paddy prices are not rising in this mandi. Wheat prices are not rising in this mandi. Vegetable prices are not rising in this mandi. Now, the reason is that demand has fallen. Almost proportionately, demand has fallen. Otherwise, it would lead to an increase in prices. So what we are talking about is an extent of fall of consumption to the extent of about 70 to 80% of food, just for food. So what keeps the prices low is hunger. What keeps the prices low is malnutrition. This is a point to be very important that we remember in this time of so-called low prices. What sustains low prices and low inflation is reduced food consumption by people in this time. I asked my vegetable vendor in a wholesale market. He said that every day, when it comes to the retail level, every day he used to sell vegetables worth 4,000 rupees. I'm talking about a middle-class market like Ville Parle in Mumbai. And this 4,000 rupees turnover has come down to 1,000 to 1,500 rupees on a daily basis after the lockdown began. So if you used to get about 700 rupees out of the 4,000 rupees sales that used to happen on a daily basis, that's 600 a day has down to something like 100 rupees a day after the lockdown began. People are not buying. People are not eating enough food in this period. So what? So we are, in some sense, though we take great pride in the fact, and there is something that is important there. I'm not dismissing that fact, because remember, the reason why the world has enough food stocks, the reason why India has enough food stocks, is because of Green Revolution. Is because of increased advance of science and technology and agriculture that has helped us to create a buffer stock of this sort. Now, having said that, however, this does not necessarily mean that people's consumption of food is as impressive as the overall production numbers are. The point to remember here is that the numbers. Hunger around us that has intensified after the crisis has begun. Now we come to what is to be done. with this kind of a situation. I started off this talk by saying that it is neither a demand shock nor a supply shock. It is actually a combination of the two in some sense. A lot of people have actually compared this to what is called as a wartime economy. Robert Kiedelski, who is the biographer of John Maynard Keynes something like a Keynesian par excellence, has come out and said that there is a possibility that we are looking at here, which is that in a wartime, what happens is a lot of your production either stops or stops because of the war, because of absence of imports of intermediate goods, which handle production, or because a lot of production facilities have been diverted to produce armaments. Now, these things would mean that more people employed in the army, et cetera, the demand does not fall to the extent that supply falls. As a result, demand remains excess of supply. So one of the issues that you would face here is that you encourage voluntary savings among people. You tell people, please don't save, please don't spend, instead please save that money. And thus you try to reduce the demand or wipe off the excess part of the demand. But it's voluntary savings, so people may not agree to save voluntarily. So the second possibility is to allow inflation to rise. So if you allow inflation to rise, what will happen is that the demand will come down and the demand and supply will at some point equalize themselves. But again, this is a regressive policy. Inflation itself could have other implications on the economy. So Keynes said that one important way to deal with it is to look at taxation as a way of bringing down demand. That is, he suggested that Britain raise the standard rate of income tax to about 50% with a top marginal rate of income tax of 97.5%. What you do is you bring in new people of new sections of taxpayers into the tax bracket, bring something like 3 million taxpayers into the tax bracket. And what you can do is that these new taxpayers can be treated like giving a loan to the government during the war. And this tax money that these new entrants into the tax bracket pay to the government can be actually paid back to them after the war as war credit, some kind of tax credits. Now, the question here is the following. Are we in an economy of that sort? Do we have a problem of excess demand resembles the kind of economy that Keynes wrote about in 1940? I'm talking about his book, How to Pay for the War, published in 1940. But for some reason, supply falls faster than demand. Now, if that is the case, what you can then, you'll then see a possibility that if supply falls faster than demand, primarily because incomes keep coming to people, primarily if you have a small sector and so on, then you are in a situation of that. But that's not where we are at this point. That's why this whole war economy, wartime economy analogy is a bit misplaced, because we are not in a state of excess demand at this point of time. We see very sharp falls in both supply and demand, and we are not yet in a situation where, given our large informal economy, our wages have also fallen, employment has also fallen, unemployment has risen. So our demand has also fallen significantly. So the excessive nature of demand as a phenomenon doesn't quite exist at present, at least as yet. So this whole analogy with a wartime economy is a bit misplaced. Now, the other is monetary policy. Now, what are countries across the world have they been trying to do? Now, after the global financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, capitalist economies, United States, Europe, etc., they have been following, United States in particular, have been following a policy of what is called as quantitative easing, QE. QE is primarily a policy measure where the government goes and buys up all the bonds in the market. When it buys bonds, it pays people who have been holding the bonds. So as a result, it is injecting enormous liquidity into the system. So it is like a measure to increase demand in the economy by putting money into the hands of people by injecting liquidity into the system. Now, that's one way of doing it. So the second measure, the first monetary policy measure that has been tried is the quantitative easing, which I have said have set limitations, and you've already exhausted it in some sense. The second aspect that I sort of flagged with respect to monetary policy was that countries have tried to reduce interest rates to bare minimums and have tried to reduce the cost of credit in those countries and try to kickstart spending and investment through borrowings. Now, here again, what you would see is most countries of the world, in the Western world, have exhausted this possibility as well, because interest rates in most parts of the world are now either zero or even negative. Negative means you have to pay the bank to keep your money. In Switzerland, it is minus 0.75%. That is what we get in India as savings bank deposit rates are about 4% and so on. It's actually the other way. This facility, this instrument is also not anymore available to the capitalist world to meet a crisis of this sort. So monetary policy in terms of quantitative easing or with respect to reducing the rate of interest, etc., are not going to be as effective as in the past. Begun what is called as fiscal stimuli, that is pushing in large amounts of money into the economy to come out of this crisis. Typically, fiscal stimulus is something that people, governments use to increase demand in the economy, respond to it. As a result, the problem is that even if you put money into the hands of people, supply disruptions are persisting. And as a result, the kind of money that you put into the hands of people is of no use because there is no supply that is responding to it. So the problem remains, unemployment remains, because only when supply picks up, will firms employ more people, pay them wages, and then further add to the demand. So that option is also not open in that classical. It's very important measures. So these are very important, large measures, unseen of in the history of capitalist worlds to save the system. This is something that tells us about the kind of flexibility with which capitalist economies can act. The same organizations like IMF till yesterday, the state was brought back in such a revolutionary way, but to save the capitalist world, but to save the capitalist system. So similarly, you saw during the great financial crisis could you please repeat this last part is a point that has come. I wanted to say that the flexibility of the capitalist system to respond to crises of this sort, to save the capitalist system itself, it should not be underestimated. The extent to which state was brought back during the Keynesian Revolution, the extent to which nationalization as an instrument was used of the state in the capitalist world today are evidence to the fact that capitalism can be, of course, changed, but also flexible to a maximum extent in order to save the capitalist system. Germany has said it very beautifully, whatever it takes, we will do. That's a political message that one can very clearly read from the kind of stimuli that you see around the world. I am sort of not going to repeat this because some of it is all, so I myself have written here and there. But in some sense, I would want to, in some sense, focus on the what countries have done with respect to small and marginal enterprises and what countries have done with respect to protecting employment. Most of the steps taken in the Western world, Europe, United States, etc., have been of the following types. In some cases, central banks have softened up small and marginal enterprises' financial constraints in a big way. They have announced moratoriums. They have announced six-month postponement, up to 6 months postponement of the interest payments. In some countries, it's 3 to 4 months. But most countries have asked the central banks to come in and soften up the finance constraints of SMEs. There is a variety of financial facilities that have been made available to these SMEs. There is temporary tax relief where you pay a deferred tax, don't pay it now. There is, in USA itself, there is this disaster relief loan program. There is direct financial support to SMEs where you give them loans at zero interest rate and no collateral. Japan, classic example. Quick loan processing. The government will stand guarantee to some of the loans, so collateral won't be a big problem. Expanding insurances in a big way. These are all measures being tried, such as resilience. And in some sense, regulatory forbearance has been brought back in its fullest possible strength to save small marginal enterprises. Look at an economy like the European Union. They are thinking of a Corona Response Investment Initiative, which is worth 37 billion euros. So 37 billion euros is being put aside by the EU for that Corona Response Investment Initiative. This is in addition EU itself of a 28 billion euro package, which will be untied, unallocated funds made available to member countries, which they can use whichever way they want. Remember the kind of protest that the EU Secretary General had when Greece wanted to borrow more. Yanis talks about it all the time. They said there is no way that we will move out of the fiscal responsibility legislation. But the same Brussels has today gone back on its word and has said whatever it takes is a fair game for all countries in the EU. The German bazooka is very important in the sense that less than 150 workers will obtain a big cash injection of between 5,000 euros and 30,000 euros. And that's the kind of extent to which they're ready to go. Most countries are helping their SMEs in multiple ways to survive. Europe is also thinking about World Bank aided pandemic bonds, where you float a bond or an epidemic bond to borrow more from the economy. The UK, it's a conservative right wing government. £330 billion Great British pounds. This is their rescue package, which is mostly into liquidity, pushing liquidity, loans to companies, cash flow support, and so on. So you see the kind of interventions that the capitalist state is ready to make to keep SMEs alive. This is the largest fiscal stimulus package ever in history. And it is not a demand stimulus. It is just a sustenance stimulus to reduce workers' exposure to workplace by introducing teleworking methods, allowing companies to use work from home as a standard measure, provide technological assistance to the countries which are ready to do this kind of stuff. Yeah, remember, when we look at the US package of $2 trillion that they announced recently, one thing that often that we don't see is there's a $100 million component to increase rural broadband internet connectivity in the United States as part of this package. Now, this means that countries are doing enormous amount of interventions to improve that part of work from home condition facility. But that's only one part of employment protection policies. The second is income replacement for sick workers. That is paid sick leave for income continuity, right? Up to 1 year for diagnosed or self-isolated people. And for others, it's up to from 50% to 80% of the last wage is now being given to sick workers. These are all reimbursement given for employers. So only if the employers are ready to keep these workers in their payroll will they get this assistance from the government. So what countries are doing is ensuring that employment is not lost and compensating the companies up to 50 to 80% to continue to pay wages to these people so that their employment is not lost and they can come back to work as the crisis ends. For those who can't work from home, some countries have announced income replacement. That is, you get paid leave at home. Working parents get leave because there are no creches anymore, daycare centers anymore. So one of the spouses have to remain at home. There is financial support as a result for alternative care arrangements. There is income support for self-employed. There are unemployment benefits. There are one-off payments. For example, the $1,200 check that Trump is going to pay to his workers is an example of one-off payment. Rent for dwellings are sometimes being paid by the government in some cases. And in many other cases, power bills, that is electricity bills, water bills, telephone bills are also subsidized by the government in a big way. So countries are doing previously unthinkable measures. They are undertaking such measures to somehow tide over this crisis for about 2 months or 3 months. Now, look at what a country like India is doing. It's a pittance. It's a shame that a country like India has not even announced an economic package for its small and medium enterprises, which are the backbone of its industrial sector. It's 90% of the workforce is informal sector workers. There is nothing for them as well as yet. So there is, in some sense, a complete silence on the part of the Indian state when the whole world is rewriting the whole, rewriting the rules of capitalist economics and doing unthinkable things to support their reforms. There is silence from the Indian government. And that's something that is extremely shocking. I made a calculation this evening, which is the following. What the government has done today is to bring in the RBI and say that there could be a moratorium on interest payments for the next 3 months. That means that you need not pay the interest rate for the next 3 months. You can start paying that interest from the fourth month onwards. Now, this has troubled a lot of people because it is not interest waiver, but it is interest postponement. So one calculation that I made was to see how much of interest income accrues to the banks in 1 year. I looked at it and I found that on a monthly basis, the whole the interest income that accrues to a bank is let's start from an yearly basis. It is about 8 lakh crore is the annual income of banks from interest. Now, if we divide this by 12, it comes to about 0.7 lakh crore per month, which is 70,000 crore. Multiply by 3 for 3 months, it comes to about 0.1 crore. So, with about 2 lakh crore, and only rupees 2 lakh crore, what the Indian government can do is that it can waive all interest payable by the Indian citizens to their banks for all their loans. And from the 4 months, can go back, they can go from the government. The government basically needs to pay 2.1 lakh crore banks, and banks can waive all the interest costs for about 3 months. They'll, of course, they're not losing anything. They're getting the interest from the government instead of from the borrowers. And it doesn't cost much. The point is, there are measures that you can think of which can have extremely widespread impacts on the economy, but the government is not appearing to be doing it. The other often mentioned question is whether we should have cash transfers. I saw a few questions popping up when I was saying something else before. Now, cash transfers are an interesting initiative at this point of time, but I believe that it may not be of much use at all for the following reason. Cash transfers, in some sense, as a relief measure, it is possible that might help here and there, but as long as supply disruptions persist, cash transfers cannot be a meaningful replacement. Cash transfers can work only if supply is also available out there, which you can, so you can use this cash to purchase things. In the presence of supply disruptions, if you go into a cash transfer policy, that is, increase demand significantly through cash transfers without allowing supplies to respond proportionately, what you would see is that there would be immediate inflation in the economy. And the value of cash transfers will immediately also come down to almost nothing. So, plus, if you give cash transfer, we do not have a digital world around us. So people have to go to the bank to get this cash transfer. People will have to go to the market to buy things. So this whole, in the China could tide over this problem because they had a very strong digital economy out in place. So they could bring that system in and handle much of the problems related to social distancing in this case. A lot of rural areas don't have bank branches. The nearest bank branch is 7 to 8 kilometers away. How will you go there in the presence of a lockdown? If you go there, or if you think of a banking correspondent who might come with a handheld biometric machine, biometric machines are banned because you can't touch the biometric reader with your finger because it's a cause for infection. So you have to look at other ways of authenticating the person. You know, there are multiple problems. There are large areas of the country without internet connection to so that digital banking can come in. There are multiple problems that exist with respect to digital payment set in the country. So cash transfers is not something, it's a bit deceptively appealing, but it's not something that might be very meaningful at this point of time. The other question that often arises here, and I'm going to wrap up in about 5 minutes from now, is that I'm looking at different options that are currently on table. The only way, so if both demand and supply are falling, what do you do? One possible solution out there is you produce only those things or increase the production and supply of those things which are outside the lockdown and are in demand. What are these things in demand? Medical equipment, ventilator, masks, medicines, essential and non-essential, and so on and so forth. So you sort of shift the levers of the economy from the usual production processes to the production of essentials and production of things which there is demand currently, and thus you try to sort of raise both supply and demand together. Now, this is easier said than done. A lot of people are saying this, but it's easier said than done because this requires a state which would come in, flex its interventionary muscles in a big way, pick up, take over prices, and start directing production as in a centrally planned economy. Would mean that the role of the private sector will have to be fundamentally rewritten in order to move into an initiative like this, which again, I don't see is a very interesting option that we have. Helicopter money and monetization is another option that is being spoken about. For example, why can't the government go back to the old form of financing a deficit, which is primarily by monetizing the deficit. What do you do? Earlier, in a pre-neoliberal period, in a country like India, the government used to issue ad hoc bills to the central bank, the RBI, and the RBI used to pass on its money, print its money, and pass it on to the government. Because the bank is getting a bill, it comes from the asset side of the bank as an asset, and it's a liability because it's printing new money and giving to the government. So assets and liabilities move up together and they cancel out in some form. And so there is no balance sheet impact on the central bank, and the government gets its money as well for spending. Now, this means that once neoliberal policies began to take root, the problem is that an argument came to be put forward that this sort of financing the deficit by the government is a problem because government is actually taking this money from the central bank at such low rates of interest that it has got an incentive to keep on borrowing. And as a result, it can be inflationary in some sense. And second, it can crowd out private investment from the economy. Now, these two arguments came to be raised by neoliberals at that time in the 90s. And over a period of time, monetization of government deficits came to be stopped. And the government had to go to the open market to borrow, just as other companies would, private companies would. As a result, the interest burden of the government went up because now they had to pay a market interest rate of 6% or 7% for these loans. But nevertheless, they had to do that because neoliberals stopped monetization because they were opposed to higher fiscal deficits. But the same neoliberals are now back and saying monetization is an option. And that's what helicopter money means. That is, this is a money that the government need not repay to the central bank, remember. Because the government is issuing an ad hoc bill to the central bank, it will keep it as an asset, and in terms of liability, it will print currency and give. So the central bank doesn't have a balance sheet issue, and the loan, the so-called loan, almost zero interest loan, can be considered as written off by the government after the financial year ends. This was an easy way. Now this kind of measure is being advocated by the same neoliberal economists who were so viscerally, ideologically opposed to monetization of fiscal deficits in the past. Now, that is yet another funny turnaround that you see within the capitalist system itself. In a sense, I've considered many of the options that are on the table. I've considered monetary policy, I've considered fiscal stimuli, whether it is demand stimuli or a relief package that we are talking about, what are different countries doing in terms of stimulus packages, whether cash transfers are an interesting alternative, whether we should think of the states taking over large parts of the production system and start producing those goods for which there is rise of China. Yes. Now, remember, there is a parallel in the Second World War that is, apart from while Europe was destructed completely, devastated by the Second World War, one await China now, where it has been able to contain its crisis to Hubei province in terms of production, capital destructions, where it has been able to revive its society and life very quickly after the crisis was averted, whether the prolonging of the crisis in the world and their continued immunity China may have for itself, whether this will mean that China will become an even more powerful economy in the world is something that has to be seen. That's something that we look forward to. Remember, one reason why the leaders of the European Union are consistently making the point about unity within the European Union is because they are very worried about China coming in and providing vast amounts of relief to countries like Italy, Spain, etc., with the reverse conditionality. Yes, conditionality, because Washington Consensus has great experience in conditionalities. China is now saying that when you open up your 5G market in Europe, our Huawei should get, in some sense, an entry point. So if this is done, we will provide you an unlimited amount of relief. Will this, in some sense, puncture the unity in the European Union and its relationship with China? Again, something that is for the not so long future, near future itself. How will the world look like? I want to I noticed very two striking things about the Financial Times in the last 2 days. 2 or 3 days back, they had an article by none other than Arundhati Roy. That is one article that they carried 2-3 days back. And April 3rd, that is day before yesterday, they had an editorial which is worth reading. It basically calls for a return of the social contract in a post-COVID world. And they basically are saying that countries which are radical, they're saying, I quote the editorial, radical reforms, reversing the policy direction of the last 4 decades, read Washington Consensus, will need to be put on the table. Governments will have to accept a more active role in the economy. They must see public services as investments rather than liabilities and look for making labor markets less insecure. I hope many of you have not collapsed by now, because the kind of side of editorial board's opinion are extraordinarily let me just say it's shocking for people like us. Redistribution will again be on the agenda. The privileges of the elderly and the wealthy will be in question. And policies until recently considered eccentric, such as basic income and, hold your breath, wealth taxes, will have to be in the mix of measures that we are suggesting. Now, this means that even a complete right-wing mouthpiece like Financial Times is now coming ahead and saying that we need to look at the world economy in a completely new way in a post-COVID period. The minimum we can say is that the market will be significantly socially regulated. Social security will come back into the game in a big way. Welfare states will be strengthened across the world. And this sort of new relationship between state and its citizens, and to use the FT word itself, that is a new social contract that was the foundation of the European welfare state in the post-war. Are we seeing a return of it in the post-COVID world? Something that is we need to look forward to repeatedly. One can only hope that some amount of pro-people measures with respect to human development, people's welfare, employment, labor market will be out there in a post-COVID world. But there is a downside to it, which is that you could also see alongside great amounts of an escalation of threats to open borders. That is anti-migrant feelings are likely to be heightened, particularly with the kind of right-wing politicians that you have in Europe. And all of this is likely to make the water a little murky, for sure. In countries like India, there is a job ahead, which is to fight for a universal social security policy in a post-COVID world. I think left movements, progressive movements have their job cut out in a post-COVID world. We have to escalate measures for the demand of universal social security policies in education, in health, in nutrition, in employment, in multiple facets of our economy. We need to chart out our demands for universal social security policies. And the building up, I say building up because countries like India never had a welfare state to begin with, to the building up of a welfare state in countries like India, to ensure that we increase our health expenditure as a share of the GDP from something like 1.5% at present to about 2.5 to 3% in the near future, over the next 1 year or 2 years, to invest in education. So there are all these initiatives in the social sector, which neoliberalism has had so meticulously killed over the last many decades. They are going to make a comeback, but the role of the left and progressive movements should be to mobilize the largest number of poor and working people behind this demand and force the hands of states to ensure that these measures are indeed brought about in the nearest future from now. I will close my comments here. Thank you very much for listening to my rather longish monologue. I hope I have covered a lot of issues, except oil prices. I've covered most of the other topics in some sense. I'm very happy to answer questions from the listeners. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Ramkumar. It was an excellent lecture, as most of the listeners will agree with me. We have some time for the question and answer session. So, Professor Ramkumar, how would you like to go about it?
Well, there are some questions that I kept seeing on the comments box.
Yes.
I have tried to answer them sort of in the later parts of the lecture. So let me just quickly go through some of them while others are preparing their questions.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now this first question by Abhinav is that given that this crisis, as I said, is an exogenous shock, the exogenous shock caused by SARS virus in 2002 did not cause a plunge in financial markets. Unlike Spanish flu, there was ample awareness in 2002. Yes and no. Because one thing that is very important to notice is that the coronavirus episode was very similar to the SARS virus episode if you look at China as an economy. China faced a sharp decline of GDP in that year, a sharp increase of unemployment in that year, a sharp destruction of wealth in the financial sector in that year. So some of the impacts that you see as due to coronavirus were noticed in the Chinese economy in 2002 itself. There again, it was an exogenous shock. It did not cause a plunge in financial markets per se, but it did cause enormous disruption in the real economy for sure. So that is something that I would like to say. Now, while it is true that without large-scale manufacturing, have indeed contributed to supporting a large-scale population, can't we attribute the increased contact of humans with wildlife to the unplanned and anarchic functioning of capitalism? Now, yes and no. That's why I said it's not an easy question to answer. I try to sort of dispute the Robert Wallace argument in two ways. First, I said that the very emergence of the so-called intensified agriculture that we speak about today is also responsible in slowing down deforestation in a big way and thus reducing the contacts between humans, wildlife, and livestock. That is something that we should not forget. Yes, there is a downside of increased contacts, and that's where we need to start thinking about questions related to biosecurity more seriously in the near future in such production systems. But whether that means going back to sort of a pre-capitalist sort of system of production is the answer to this is something that I wouldn't go with. Spanish flu came in 1918, or the earlier flus came in earlier years, not because of capitalist production systems. They came when such production systems were absent, yet they came. And after the Spanish flu, as I said, you have, thanks to the autonomous expansion of science and technology and their incorporation into public health systems across the world, you have a significant reduction in mortality in the last century. You have a significant rise in life expectancy rates, the fall of death rates, etc. And this is also that has happened under the auspices of capitalism. What I'm trying to say is that we need to take all these factors into account, and simply saying that the unplanned and anarchic functioning of capitalism leads to increased contacts of humans with wildlife is a very simplistic way of putting it. And my request in my lecture was to see it in a more wholesome form, in a in a larger canvas of whether the same agriculture that we are speaking about has also led to decreased deforestation, something that we need to think about further. The question about Italy, Spain, and the mortality rates among the elderly, I have answered in the middle of my lecture. I'm looking for the next question. Can we expect the terms of trade to improve for agriculture in the time, given the rise in world agricultural prices? Yes and no, because the point I was making was what you see is currently a fall in agricultural prices because of reduced demand in countries like India. Now, to what extent will consumption pick up from here onwards and demand for food can be reestablished as in a pre-COVID period, and how world trade will be reformatted by COVID in a post-COVID world are all factors that we need to take into account before passing a judgment on how terms of trade will improve. There is an increase in world prices, but that is primarily because countries are not trading. Thailand has stopped its rice exports, so rice prices are rising. Kazakhstan and Russia likely is to restrict its wheat exports. Wheat prices are rising. In the post-COVID world, if the trade restarts again, prices may fall. And you may come back to the back into a pre-COVID time. But will trade remain the same? Will protectionism expand? Is free trade dead? All these are questions that we need to think about once the crisis is over and where we are at that point of time. Will monthly payments to every person in the country, regardless of income, also work? Again, I said, cash payments always will hit the constraint of supply. It should not ultimately lead to an unlimited increase in demand without a proportionate response in supply. That is a sure recipe for inflation if you do that, and great social unrest. I'm not saying keep consumption down, but you need to think about other innovative ways, including universalizing your public distribution system, where people are provided food free of cost, which thus can be less non-inflationary. You need to try those kinds of systems, till the time we are out of this lockdown, monthly cash payments from the government to the poor is always a way in which government has copped out of its responsibilities of providing social security and essential goods for the poor. It basically is telling the people, I have given you money, my job is done, you go and figure out your way in the market with that money. That's why it is a part of neoliberal policies. That's why cash transfers are an essential component of neoliberalism, because it is essentially a way in which the government is saying that it's not my responsibility anymore after I've given you the cash transfer. That is something that we need to remember when we think about cash transfers as a solution to this crisis. When the flow of money will increase, the demand will... Yes, of course, SFS has answered that question in roughly the same way as I said it. From the quantitative easing part, Deepa says that it broke up. Yes, I mentioned that as well. They have wound up the QE policy by now, particularly in the United States. I am looking for the next question. Please give me a few seconds. Thank you for posting the links of my writings that can be read, of course. Is it a window to the left? Will this COVID time measures show the path in measures to climate change that are also urgently needed? Now, there's a very interesting interview with Noam Chomsky on the internet, in YouTube, which you might want to see. Noam Chomsky is in self-isolation, and he participates through Skype. But Noam makes this point that that just as the ability of the present capitalist system to address issues of climate change are limited, so is the ability of the capitalist societies of today to face the health crisis of today, thanks to Corona, because of the last 4 decades of destruction of public health itself. So there are parallels that he sees. I'm not an expert in climate change, but I would say that a system based on profits, a system that is fundamentally based on speculation, will always be less effective than a state-led democratic system to address any such crisis. So in that sense, the policies to address climate change, of course, will have to be part and parcel of the demands that the left and progressive movements raise, along with the demand for a universal social security system. There is no doubt about it. I'm coming to this question of Abhinav again. I said Marxist economics doesn't have a solution. Doesn't Marxist economics have explanation for any type of crisis? Of course. Marxist economics has an extraordinary robust explanation to the financial crisis and all forms of capitalist crisis. It is Marx in Volume 3 of Capital who put forward the idea of disproportionality crisis, who put forward the idea of consumption and overproduction, who put forward the idea of the tendency of the rate of profit, who put forward the idea of fictitious capital. These are they have been extremely insightful arguments in Marx, in Capital, which you can see in every crisis of capitalism in the 20th century. Look at the Great Depression of 1929. Look at the financial crisis of 2007. Look at this crisis. Every crisis you see how his argument that any disturbance to the circuit of capital, as is entrenched in the global capitalist economy of those times, can actually create either disproportionality or underconsumption, or a long-term tendency of the rate of profit to fall, which can create multiple types of crisis of different varieties. And the fragility of the capitalist system based on private property, based on speculative finance, is something that Marx laid out 200 years back. 150 years back. So to say that Marxist economics doesn't have a solution is a very simplistic point. It is wrong as well. What I was saying was, this kind of crisis that coronavirus has created, the shock hits and demand and supply together fall, and you have a strange situation whereby even the standard Keynesian policies do not work. That is something that is new, and it's new to Marxists as well. There's nothing wrong in saying it. If Abhinav goes on to say that if this crisis is purely due to exogenous factors, which I believe it is, because the links between capitalism per se and the virus per se are pretty weak in my view. There is no reason that the economy should grow back from where it left off. I never said that. I don't see the economy growing back after 3 months from where it left off. That's completely out of place. The world economy is going to be very different, even if it is not a switch on, switch off thing. I mentioned it very clearly that the effort of Western economies is to somehow hold on till the crisis is over. But that has not prevented unemployment. That has not prevented job losses. That has not prevented shutting down of companies. That has not prevented great destructions of GDP and capital. What you will see after 3 months or 2 months or 1 month, wherever the economy reopens, is that the state of demand and supply will be fundamentally different. Some losses will be irreplaceable. Some losses would be irreversible. So there is absolutely no no assurance that even the large extents of fiscal stimulus packages on the West will help them in any form to switch on and switch off. They will have to be ready for even greater stimuli into those markets to sort of crawl back into normalcy after the crisis has ended. So it is something that we have to be prepared for in some sense. Since the profitability of capital will continue to be strong, even higher, I'm not sure on what assumptions you're reaching that conclusion, then we will be simply having a V-shaped curve. Well, whether it's a V or a U or an L or an I is something to be seen. But of course, there will be sharp recovery after a sharp decline because the base will be low. Because if you're having 3 months of negative growth rates in the GDP, the fourth month will be an extraordinarily sharply growing period. That's the statistical truth. But that does not mean replacement of capital. That does not mean replacement of jobs. That does not mean replacement of the different forms of capitals that are lost in this period. There'll be a Pyrrhic victory at the end of this. What some people are saying is that the death of large number of elderly in Italy is going to allow Italy to actually go faster in a post-COVID world. It's a completely inhuman kind of an analysis. But yes, and purely statistically speaking, such a thing might happen. But that doesn't mean that there is a replacement of the capital and wealth that is lost in any form. Unless we move to a planned economy, yes, I do see. Look, when I say that Marxist economics does not have an answer to this, what I'm trying to say is even Marxist economists have not faced a crisis of this sort in the past. No socialist country has faced a crisis of this sort in the past. This is something that is unique to the world history, and hence even Marxist economists have to learn afresh from this crisis. It is not everything that we have been doing till now. Let's just dispose it off and enter into a new Marxist planned world. That's not going to happen that way. We can hope for it, we can dream for it, we can struggle for it, we can fight for it. But whether that will happen in reality is something that neither Abhinav nor I can say. Whether capitalism will survive this, it may survive. It has survived the Great Depression. It did survive the financial crisis. It survived two world wars. It has survived many other forms of health and economic crisis. It may survive this as well. But whether it will be the same capitalism, was the pre-war capitalism the same as post-war capitalism? No. But was it capitalism nevertheless? Yes. So you would see a very reformatting of capitalism. It's very possible. Will capitalism look exactly the same? I'm sure no. But will capitalism survive? It may well. Will workers' movements get a fillip from this crisis? Indeed, it will. Whether they should or will push for revolution? Yes, they should. And they will. But whether the objective factors on ground will aid us in this process is something that remains to be seen. And we should be as careful and as respectful of complexity as we should be ever. Because simplifying some of these crises and simplifying the solutions of this crisis, from simplifying to being simplistic, is easy in words, but it can be extremely disastrous as a political strategy, particularly for Marxists. Now, this is something that I wanted to say with respect to the repeat of Abhinav's question. Snehal asked this question. Agricultural laborers are also badly affected. What can be done to improve their situation? I have mentioned this in a sense in my lecture. That is, you need to bring in food security to every house in this country. You need to provide them health cover. You need to provide them food cover for the time of the lockdown. It is extremely important. If you see a place like Kerala, you would see that it is not just the simple distribution of food grains to the poor free of cost, but you also see is that you have got in every panchayat community kitchens that have opened up. About 1,000 food stalls have been opened up where you can eat a meal for about 20 to 25 rupees. You have community kitchens in every panchayat where the local panchayat president leads a team to build a small kitchen in one place where people can come, of course, respecting social distancing requirements, come and eat and go. And where they are not able to come and eat, they are home delivered in very safe surroundings. So this, we need to provide facilities for the poor so they can go through this lockdown safely. You need to provide them food. You need to provide them with health covers. That's extremely important. Now, once we slowly come out of this lockdown, once supply opens up, supply disruptions are over, then the room for demand stimulus is available. At that point of time, the role of the state will have to be escalated. It will come up in a big way, and you would actually see some kind of Keynesian policies for sure in different parts of the world, including in India. In India, I say, because you just cannot do without it. You have to increase your spending in the economy. Otherwise, the economy will just collapse. So in India also, I see that coming up very, very soon. But to whether it like happen to the extent of the fiscal stimuli in the Western world, I'm very doubtful. You have mentioned that health sector stimulus is the correct way to go. Do you think in this COVID and lockdown situation, the linkages to the health sector will increase or decrease? It is already increasing in some sense. But the point I was trying to make is, in a post-COVID world, can you institutionalize the universal public health system, which is not based on the failed insurance model of the United States, which is based on something like the NHS model of United Kingdom, which allows everyone to go to a public health clinic and get treatment free of cost. Now, that whether that kind of expansion of public health systems will become possible after the COVID and lockdown situation. I think that's what I was saying when I said universal social security has to be pushed for. What I meant implicit in that was also an expansion of health sector, raising expenditure and investment in the health sector. Celebration of the private health sector in India as a possible substitute for the public health sector, bringing in insurance to replace the presence of brick and mortar clinics on the ground, owned by and run by the government. That's something that should not be allowed. That is something that should be very clear for workers' movements across the world. So I do see a very strong... the Financial Times editorial also even incidentally refers to it. So that is an opportunity that the progressive movements have to grab and push for in a very big way as soon as this lockdown is ending. Yes, thank you, Deepa, for posting Chomsky's video. It was a great joy, but the extent to which he has aged is something that was extremely saddening for me. But I salute the courage and energy of the man who stuck to that system single-handedly over the years. From lighting candles to labeling it China virus, it's very clear that the scientific world has restated again and again, including in a very important letter to a journal called Lancet, that the different stories that are around us with regard to this was a bioweapon invented in a Chinese lab, which somehow got leaked out, and it does not have wildlife origin, that has been comprehensively rejected by scientists across the world as wrong. So labeling it as such a China virus is, you see it being used by Donald Trump in a big way, and implicitly by the IT cell in India, may I say. It's the IT cell in India which has taken over WhatsApp and social media spaces with this thing that it is a Chinese thing which has come. Now, remember, I think China's intervention was at best about a week or two late, not more than that, in my view. It had very clear origins in wildlife. It had very clear origins in the wet markets, as we call it. These wet markets are different from wildlife markets. Remember, there is a very there are very interesting articles that are available now to look at wet markets in a completely new way. Some of the photographs of wet markets in China that you would see would resemble you of the Reliance Fresh kind of corporate showrooms in India. So the whole imagery that we have in our mind with respect to what a wet market is in China has to be rewritten in some form. But having said that, I think China was very quick in responding to it. It put out the genetic makeup for the world to see, which is actually what is aiding world governments across the world to develop vaccines, tests, and so on. So the role of China is being invoked again and again by those governments which are clueless about how to react domestically to this public health scare. Now, this that includes Donald Trump, that includes Narendra Modi. All these are rulers who have been clueless about how to deal with a crisis of this sort in the domestic economy. And as is the wont with right-wing populism across the world and historically, you have to find an external enemy and pin the blame on that other and not domestically. Your failure has to be hidden, and the role of an external other agency or a person or country has to be highlighted to mask your failures. That is exactly what right-wing populists like Modi or Trump are doing, to hide their failures and to play up the role of China and to pin the blame there and not on them. I think that's a classic right-wing policy that we can see here as well. How far this crisis opened up chances for UBI replacing MGNREGS? Well, look, UBI, again, I am a great skeptic of UBI. There is substantive literature, persuasive literature in social policy around the world that a policy that delinks work and income is something that is extremely problematic, not just in a philosophical sense, but also in a practical policy sense. It is important that you allow workers to gain income through work, which in turn creates assets, which in turn creates new demand for wages, and which in turn creates a multiplier effect in the economy. That is not the same as giving people cash and forgetting it. So UBI per se can be tried as a supplement here and there, but whether it is a replacement for MGNREGS, my answer is an unequivocal no. Similar is my answer if you ask me whether all the PDS shops should be closed down and whether people should be given transfers in cash instead of grain in kind. My answer is no, never. I do see some chance for UBI coming in, but I would remain deeply skeptical of its efficacy in terms of resolving the social contradictions we have at this point of time. Are we looking at a shift from a want-based economy to a need-based economy? No. So Amitabh's argument in the interview to print that we are facing a fourth industrial revolution, a digital revolution. Well, look, the expansion of digital technology, the expansion of new forms of exchange, banking, that is happening. The coming in of artificial intelligence, robotics, etc., which is what he refers to as the fourth industrial revolution, is an autonomous change that you are seeing parallel to whatever frailties that we have in our capitalist system. This will be used by the capitalist system. This will also create new contradictions in the capitalist system. For example, by expanding each large-scale employment, the army of labor in a big way, and sort of undermining the ability of the same capitalist system to create livelihoods for these people. So whether this fourth industrial revolution is going to be a seamless, peaceful sort of a shift all across the world, which it has faced historically, every future, it is complete bogus. That's complete nonsense. Fourth industrial revolution, if at all it happens, and to the extent that it happens, will lead to certainly new contradictions in the capitalist economy, which as we go by. As posted by Anil Arora, thank you very much. That's a letter I was referred to. Going to be a reality for some time. And because we'll have record production of food grains, production of food grains is unlikely to be adversely affected. But supply chain disruptions will depend upon how far the crisis proceeds. I will leave it there. I think I've answered most of the questions, and I will be back to moderate. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Professor Ramkumar, for this excellent lecture, as well as staying and answering almost all the questions that have come up in the chat window, despite the fact that we have overshooted our scheduled time. For the benefit of the listeners, I would just summarize the key arguments that Professor Ramkumar highlighted. In fact, starting with the uniqueness of this crisis in triggering demand as well as supply side shocks, it's also important to note that the nature of country-specific systems in state capacity as well as healthcare has resulted in differential impacts of the coronavirus across regions. And world over, we see that there is an abandonment of neoliberal economics in favor of enormous stimulus packages as well as redistributive measures to sustain the system. Contrary to this, we see that the Indian response has been grossly inadequate and is much more notable for its silences and absences rather than devising a concrete policy response with nuance and attention to detail. He reminded us that where a post-coronavirus world goes from here depends much on class-based mobilization and organized politics, and much of this should be done with attention to the complexity of concrete material conditions. Thank you once again, Professor Ramkumar, and hope to host you again sometime soon. The lectures are all recorded and will be uploaded on platforms like Spotify. You can find them by searching for Bodhi Commons. Please do follow Bodhi Commons on social media, where you can find updates about the articles we publish as well as the programs that we host. We will be continuing with the Marxian Political Economy lectures by Professor Venkatesh Athreya tomorrow. The lectures will begin as usual as 9 p.m. Hope to see you tomorrow again. Thank you once again, Professor Ramkumar. Good night.